Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello and welcome to episode 196 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. Well, I've only gone and got myself a bit of COVID, haven't I? You may be able to hear it in my voice. I've got a bit of a sore throat, so I won't be on here too long. Firstly, as ever, our Patreon supporters, thank you very much, without whom we would not be able to produce this podcast. And if you like what you hear and you want to give us a bit of financial support to keep the podcast growing, that will be absolutely brilliant. You can go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile, click on the Linktree drop-down box, and that will take you over to their Patreon page. And like I said last week, Kersler Arts annual exhibition is on at the Royal Festival Hall. It's called Freedom, and it was curated by Ai Weiwei. It normally has about 250 artworks, but, you know, Ai Weiwei likes to do things different, and this year he's got around about 1,800. So please, if you're passing the South Bank, I urge you to go and have a look round. It really is a powerful exhibition. Well, this week, like last week, we've got ourselves a stone carver featuring on an episode. And today, I'm going to be taking you to meet Tom Waugh. I only come across Tom's work a couple of months ago. I can't remember fully, but I think I come across it on my Instagram feed. And his work proper blew me away. So much so, I just contacted him straight away and asked if he'd come on and record an episode. If you want to hear other episodes featuring sculptors, stone carvers, there's last week's episode, and that was Beth Cullen-Kerridge. Or there's Richard McNess, who is episode 182. But for now, come and join me on episode 196, when I spoke over Zoom to sculptor and stone carver Tom Waugh.
I'm in Somerset, yeah, West Somerset.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah, and that's where I'm from originally. Well, I'm from Devon actually, but I lived and studied in London for quite a while. My wife's a Londoner, and then we moved back. But for a few lot of different reasons, but a lot of it was what the work I do. I need quite a lot of space and I make quite a lot of mess.
Yeah.
And it was just trying to find somewhere affordable in London was, you know, it's a nightmare. So,
well, Tom, I do have seven questions that I ask each artist.
Yeah.
I'm sure that what you've already said has given a bit of a hint.
But, yeah.
How would you explain what you do to people that don't know your work?
So I work in stone and marble and, really it's hyper realism, I guess, and so you know, subject matters often things like crumpled cardboard boxes, very realistically carved, and I use different stones to look like the material that I'm copying. So I use a lot of white marble, which looks like white plastic. And so some of the works are oversized. So I've done some giant knives and forks and big tablet packets and things like that. And then there's another side to the work that I do, which is these fossil pieces. So I'll get a rough boulder or a piece of alabaster. I pick up alabaster on the beach and watch it near me. And I'll, from the rock, I'll carve, you know, bits of rubbish like coffee lid or, you know, a petrol can, as if it's within the rock, as if it's just been found. So that's another side. And then more recently, I've done a big public art project, which was through the Royal Society of Sculptors. And that was a bit of a learning curve for me. I've heard you speak, I think you were speaking to Ali Rosenberg about this. Once you, you know, this was all steel and glass. So it was a bit of a departure for me. So when you're dealing with organizations that don't usually deal with artists, it's a different thing entirely, yeah, you know. Yeah. So having to get structural engineers involved and you know, people doing the welding and having to try and explain exactly what you want, you know, in practical terms, it's a different thing. But that's in Harrow, and that's on the site of an old Kodak factory. So the proposal I put forward was for a giant camera lens, which is about 3 and a bit meters tall, including the plinth, and it's got an animation on the glass, which as you move around it looks like a camera aperture opening and closing. But it's all analog, there's no electricity, it's just literally these vertical lines that mask the animation as you move around it. It animates.
Was that what they wanted?
Well, it's like with all these, you know, when there's an open call, you kind of read between the lines, don't you? So in the sort of proposal, they were talking a lot about the Kodak factory. It's Persimmon Homes, who have done a housing development in Harrow on the site of, I think it was actually the playing fields for the factory. So, well, the fact, you know, don't get many factories now that have their own playing fields, do you? But
no.
Kodak factory had this huge bit of green space, which was open space for the factory workers, and they're built on that. And so in the blurb for the proposal, they were talking a lot about that. The other thing is they, you know, with public art, maintenance is a huge issue. So they want to know it's maintenance free, it's going to last a certain amount of time. So, you know, it was a combination of those things, using steel and glass and tying in with the Kodak factory. That's kind of, yeah, it was, you know, successful. It was it was a long old process, you know, getting it to the stage where it could be made. It's up there now. And
how did you feel coming out of your comfort zone, as it were, without a sort of a hammer and chisel in your hand?
I mean, I think as the process went on, I got into it, but it's difficult. It is difficult giving up that control, you know, and you know, usually I work just on my own completely, you know. So, and it was, I think, 4 different companies that were involved in the production. So I, you know, I did a bit of, you know, finishing welds, you know, grinding back welds and stuff. Yeah. I did what I could practically, but actually, you know, really, it was just, I just designed it and was overseeing it. And that was a bit strange, actually.
For someone that uses hammer and chisel, and it's all your work is, you know, is pretty much 100% you. How did it feel handing over the reins for one piece?
Yeah, it was just very different. You just got to kind of have a lot of faith, really, in the people that are doing the work, and, you know, try not to get involved when it's, you know, trust that their level of expertise is right, and, you know, all that side of things. Was for years getting used to I've worked in teams of people, but not on my own work, you know. So that was a bit different, really. Yeah, you know, it was But they were great. I mean, the guys that did it, the guys that did the glass and the guys that did all the steel work, you know, they were brilliant. They were really understanding. And yeah.
Did you have creativity in the home growing up, Tom?
My dad was a cabinet maker and a wood carver, but he did a mixture of carving and, you know, general joinery. And so it was always around. And it, you know, I used to go in the workshop and do bits and pieces, but I honestly sort of never really thought of that as something that I would end up doing, that type of thing, I guess. And it was always around. And so Dad had lots of art books and a lot of books about carving and all that. So it was all around me. So, you know,
it was art carving he'd done, not just moulding.
A mixture. So it was things like he might be commissioned to do like a bookcase that might have some little carved details
on it.
Often they get commissioned by churches to do statues and stuff. So it was quite traditional, but he very much had his own style, because with the carving he was self-taught really. So he studied the joinery and cabinet making, and then the carving he sort of taught himself. So he had quite recognizable style looking back, I think. Yeah.
And did you pick up a hammer and chisel in those days?
A bit, but not, I mean, a little bit, but never as a sort of, you know, I liked art at school, and I always, looking back, I think I always gravitated towards sculpture and 3D stuff. I used to get quite frustrated drawing and painting. I remember primary school, I was used to sort of like do something and then just destroy it because I wasn't happy with it. And but when it was 3D stuff, it felt more natural. I suppose. And then I went on to do A-level art. I did GCSE and A-level art, and actually I didn't do very well at A-level art because I just couldn't get my head around the whole write, you know, having to write a lot about work.
Yeah.
I just want to make it. And so I think I sort of did quite badly because I just wasn't, you know, I didn't do enough of the writing bit, you know. So it put me off a bit, actually. So then I went on and to do music more, actually. And that was more what I was focused on, I guess. And then I came back to art just by chance, really, because I was living in Bristol, and I'd been just doing temporary jobs sort of in my early 20s, working on building sites and call centers and whatever, really. Yeah. And I had a bit of a gap in employment, and you know, I was trying to do the music thing and all that. And then I went on the New Deal. Do you remember that? Labour's New Deal.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where basically, you know, they're trying to get young people back into work. So I was in a, you know, I had to go into an office every day where they'd, you know, get me to fill in loads of application forms and stuff. And the church next door to that New Deal office was being restored. So I just thought, well, that, you know, and I was watching the stonemasons doing their thing. You know, that was in St. Paul's in Bristol, which is sort of, then it was a bit of a rough area of Bristol, but it was a lovely, lovely church. And I could, you know, I could hear the sort of hammers going. I thought, that looks all right. So I went on and asked for a job, and I started labouring, sweeping up on this
brilliant
church site. And then I sort of was looking at what the masons were doing, and I said, can I have a go? And I started doing a bit of carving. And but it was all
obviously the easier bits, you know, it weren't the eyes and nose.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't think that had happened now. And it wasn't anything figurative or decorative. It was like window surrounds and mouldings.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a bit of a thing in masonry. I don't know if it's still sort of a thing, but it was a college and on sites. It was, you know, the masons, if you wanted to do anything a bit arty or a bit creative, they'd say, oh, you don't want to do that arty farty shit, you know, to really look down on. But I think a part of that was because everyone actually wanted a go, you know, but it was easy to find your way into doing the more decorative artistic stuff. So anyway, from there, they sent me to college. So I was going, you know, I was doing 3 days or something a week at the church and 2 days at the college. And and I guess at the college, what sort of changed things is a tutor came in and literally just got everyone carving a flower. And it wasn't part of the syllabus. Yeah. And the other tutors weren't that happy about it. Arty-farty shit, whatever.
Yeah.
I loved it. And I was just, you know, so just that one little carving that I did, it made me think, well, actually, I can do this. I can do, you know, I can carve stone to look like something, not just, you know, to put something around a church window.
Yeah.
You know, so I found then from there, when I'd done that course, I found there was a 3-year diploma at City and Guilds in London, which was just carving. So it's architectural carving, but you did a lot of figurative sculpture, portrait sculpture. So it's my, you know, started working clay, copying a lot of casts, but it was like a very traditional, almost like a sculpture course would have been, you know, 100 years ago or something. It was, you know, and I loved it. Like, yeah, so I spent 3 years there doing that. And that's kind of, the art bit is a different story, to be honest with you. But that's how I kind of got into stone, basically, yeah.
And from there, did you go on to work in, you know, like you was doing before? Did you move up the ladder to be one of the carvers?
Yeah, so
the masons, sorry.
Yeah, no. So I was already a mason. So yeah, when I was at college doing the carving, I was at weekends. I was funding the course I was doing by doing the masonry work, mainly on houses in London. You know, so you know, replacing stone window sills and all and that sort of stuff. But the sculpture side of it, one of the big things actually was that during one of the summer holidays, there's a sculptor called Peter Randall Page who is based in Devon, and he is an RA now. He wasn't then, but I went to work for him. So that was my first experience of kind of fine art sculpture, working with people that were doing that, and you know, and all these little steps sort of just made it seem more possible that I could, you know, because I always felt a little bit that it was quite inaccessible, you know. Even when I was doing A-level art, it was, I loved doing it, but actually thinking about doing it as a job, or you know, trying to actually become an artist, it just seems, you know, I don't know.
It's as if there's not really a route for it, is there? It's like sort of opening up a sheep pen and everyone just sort of wanders off, you know?
No, exactly. And it was a bit like that when I left college, to be honest, as well. It's like that thing where, you know, and then when I left college, we moved because of the thing that I was talking about, trying to find more affordable space to work in, plus my stepson, Brandon, and I've got family, you know, so I've family down here in the Southwest. So for a few different reasons, we moved back down to the Southwest. But then when that happened, you know, the work sort of dropped. I mean, actually, I got a big commission when I just left college, which was a classical statue for a library in North Wales. So I needed a bigger space to make that. Yeah. And then once I'd made that piece, then it was like, sort of felt like opportunities ran out a little bit. And I spent quite a long time, you know, doing stuff like, you know, building stone walls and, you know, quite basic stuff to keep the money coming in, you know. So you know, that was and then I guess I just started as a sort of sideline making these realist sculptures. So I made a cardboard box, one of the cardboard box, the first one I did, and I had a little community show there was a arts festival community show, and I did a first exhibition I'd ever done with a painter friend, and that was about 2015, I think. And I've had three pieces in. She had some paintings. I wasn't expecting to sell anything, and I sold two out of the three pieces that I was exhibiting to people that I didn't know as well. So that was a big thing for me. I've suddenly thought, oh, God, people actually buy this. You know, believe it. Yeah. You know, and that sort of spurred me on. I had to. Whatever I was doing at that stage, having a young family, I've got two boys, Sid and Isaac, and they were little at the time. I had to keep the money coming in. So it actually made me think, well, actually, I can't, the artwork can be part of my income.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, before I was just making the work, doing it because I was loving doing it. And then it suddenly shifted and became sort of possible that I might, you know, might be able to continue, kind of thing. You know, so.
So you mentioned that for this, that you put in a cardboard box. Could you just describe the size, the texture of, yeah, of that, yeah, box?
So it wasn't very big. It's probably about maybe 20 centimetres square and about 15 centimetres high, something like that. And it's very crumpled and squashed.
Yeah.
And really, I mean, all the things I'd learned at college about copying drapery. So we'd do a project where we'd carve a bit of cloth and make it look very realistic, as you would on a classical sculpture. So all those sorts of things feed in. And I used Portland stone, which when you polish it, comes darker and shiny. So where the tape would have been on the cardboard box, I polished those bits so that it looked nice. Like sellotape, you know. And that was the one thing people were like, oh, it's really good, but why have you stuck sellotape on it? And they touch it. Oh, right, you have.
Yeah, that little bit of unexpected, exactly, wow factor, yeah, if you like, yeah.
And that's what I always go for my stuff. And the boxes, that the more recent boxes, I have some little polystyrene packers made out of white marble that sit on top of it. So that's the extra little thing where people kind of go, oh yeah, but you've got some poly, and then they touch it and realise it's marble. Yeah.
Nice.
But I think when I was, that thing about the unexpected, you know, that really hit me. The first time I thought about art which could have that sort of impact was when I saw Richard Wilson's oil piece.
Yeah.
I think I saw it in the Saatchi when I was a teenager. And you know, you walk down that sort of walkway and you don't quite know what's going on. It's like, are you looking down? Is there glass, yeah, there? Yeah. And then it takes a little while to realize what it is. And that's, you know, that's the art that I really like. So, and that's what I try and do with my work, really.
That cardboard box, was that the first piece that you'd created that wasn't a traditional looking image?
Trying to think. Yeah, no, I think it was. Yeah. And then the three pieces I had in that community show was a fag butt. A big one. It was like about 2 foot tall, sort of stubbed out on a plinth.
Yeah,
and that,
yeah,
was in three different stones, and a plastic cup, you know, like the type of really cheap plastic cup you get. You know, I don't know if you really get them that much anymore, but the really crinkly ones. And that was like a twice life size one in alabaster. Yeah. And the cup and the box sold. The fag butt I've still got, actually, because, you know, it's a bit of a hard sell.
Well, that's always a perfect thing to do is make something outsize.
Yeah, yeah.
Or likewise, giving it a new texture or weight, you know, yeah, of the material. I mean, yeah, the one that comes to mind for me personally is Gavin Turk's bin bags.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's I met Gavin because he was a judge on the Rise Art Prize, actually. And yeah, so there's definite parallels with his work. And now his work's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, very much so.
No, definitely. And also Ron Mueck, I never quite know how to say his surname, Mueck. But but those things are both, right, oversized or undersized, hyper-realist works. It's always just got that real, you know, that impact. It's sort of instant, isn't it? Yeah, no, what I've got in the workshop at the moment working on is I'm doing a giant pill pot. So, like, you know, the white plastic,
yeah,
tablet pot, yeah, the lid's off, sitting on the ground, and it's going to have pills inside it and some on the ground. It's about just over half a metre tall. So that's, and that's a whole series of Big Pharma, I call it. Big Pharma, I've got a huge tablet, wall-mounted tablet packets. And
brilliant. The one that caught my eye was the tablet blister.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
where you'd taken a couple of the pills out, as it were.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of them were deflated or indented, rather.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that one, that proper... I couldn't see the scale at first, and then you had it in front of you, and it was possibly just over a metre wide.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, exactly. They're really good fun to make, those, and they're popular. So, yeah, I've got, that series will probably keep going. I've done quite a few, just the individual tablets, because I always just like to have some smaller, more affordable, work, you know, it's, I think you talked about that, about starting, you know, producing prints and stuff like that, because it's, because of the amount of time and the material, it's not that affordable. So I've done quite a few of these small tablets that are, that, you know, a bit more sort of accessible and affordable. Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A question sort of unrelated, really. It's just come to me as you was talking there. How do you source your materials?
So there's a mixture of things. So to start off with, I was always using offcuts from the from jobs that I had done. So a bit, so the extra bits of stone that, you know, you cut off a bit because you're taking off a bit of material to make something. And so that was initially. And then a lot of the pieces for the blister pack, for the tablet packets, I've got from reclamation yards, actually, because getting marble from Italy can be really expensive. But actually, old fireplaces often they have marble hearth or something, and you can find those in reclamation yard for like sometimes like, you know, 100 quid, 50 quid for a big, you know. So for the relief stuff, the wall mounted stuff, often that's where it comes from. And also, there's a few different stone suppliers that I use to get stone for the masonry jobs that often have off cuts or the end of a block. But I've started buying more actually as I've been selling more. But initially it was always, you know, getting bits from reclamation yards or using off cuts. Or
one of the artworks you've done, and I don't know the name of the actual machine, the carving machine. What are they called?
Well, it's an industrial robot, really, or a CNC machine. So it's CNC. Yeah,
I love the idea of hand carving one of those. I thought it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
You. Yeah, well, I made that for the National Sculpture Prize, which is at Broomhill in Devon, and Gavin actually was one of the judges on that. So that's the second time he's been a judge on a competition I've been in. First one. Was Rise Art in 2018, which was Richard Wilson and Gavin Turk were two of the judges, and I got the best sculptor and people's choice for that. For the Broomhill one, I didn't win. There's some really good people in that, but it was great to meet him again and have a chat.
Have you seen any work with one of those machines?
Any work made with one of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have. I've seen them used by sculptors, and a lot of carvers and sculptors have a real problem with it. They feel like it's cheating somehow. But I mean, we all use angle grinders. You know, that's another tool which cuts time down. I mean, I don't use them because I really enjoy the process of carving. But that's not to say there might be a job in the future where it's going to be so much easier and cheaper to use that technology.
Sorry, where I was going with this, Tom.
Yeah.
If you look at the work of one of those machines.
Yeah.
Can you see that it wasn't made by hand? I don't know. So
I think there's a couple of things. So often when those machines are used, a sculptor might model in clay first, then have that 3D scanned. And then the CNC machine will copy it exactly. And then you can very much tell that the surface is a modeled surface, not carved surface. So it looks a bit weird because you've got a marble object that looks like it's been modeled in clay.
Yeah.
But if it's done in the right way, if they leave, you know, 2 mil off the surface and then finish it by hand and carve it and put the tool marks on. Sometimes you can't tell, but it all, like any tool and any technology, it all, it depends how it's been used, doesn't it? You know, and yeah, I mean, I'm in this group show off, you know, in Oxfordshire, which is all stone carving. It's called On Form. And one of the, and it's usually about 30 sculptors. It's every other year. And it's a really good show, real variety of work, although it's all stone. But there was one of the sculptors there that, you know, turns out was using CNC machines. And they're all, a lot of other carvers are like up in arse, sculpting kind of up in arse. And I just thought it's fine. I mean, like the type of work that he was doing, he's working granite, very geometric. You know, the design of the work was amazing. It, you know, to me, it's like, it's fine. But yeah, the piece, I'm Not a Robot, I mean, just to describe it, it's a robot arm that's carving itself from a block of marble. So the bottom half of it is all blocky and you can see the lines and it's actually sort of leaning down and carving itself. And it's called I'm Not a Robot because when you get, when you click on a website, asks you to verify that you're not
yeah,
robot.
Yeah.
I always find that a bit funny, though. It's kind of a computer getting you to confirm that you're not a robot, basically a robot making sure you're not a robot. It's this weird sort of circle thing. Yeah, and it's also about technology and progress and what's the end goal of artificial intelligence and machine learning, you know.
It's, yeah.
Ask all those questions, really, I guess, yeah.
I'd seen a few paintings in the past where it would be, the painting would be the painter painting himself
yeah.
on a canvas or...
Yeah, like the Escher.
Exactly, hand,
yeah. There's Rodin did a lot of a kind of unfinished, what looked unfinished sculpture, so your head emerging from a block and you know, you still see the rough block and all that, yeah. Yeah, no, I like all that.
Which piece, Tom, that you've created do you think has got the strongest emotional connection?
I guess it, well, it's going to be one of two, I guess. So, it's either going to be the flower, that little flower, because I gave that to my now wife and, that I carved at college purely because when I look back at that, I think, well, if that guy hadn't come in and got us all carving, you know, doing something that wasn't in the syllabus and getting us enthusiastic, then I might not be doing what I'm doing now. So it's either going to be that, or there's another piece which is kind of, it's part, about 4 or 5 years ago I did a restoration of it's a bridge, but it's in the sort of grounds of this stately home, and it was and it's this kind of bridge with these two figures on either side, and up these sort of copings of this bridge are all kind of rock carved in stone, rocks and seaweed and pearls.
Nice.
And it's as if it's sort of it's from the 18th century, and it's as if it's sort of an underwater treasure, but I had to replace a whole of one side of it, so it was all, so I was matching but making it different, if you imagine it's symmetrical but not, so
yeah.
I was having to sort of make up, and it's like a sort of, in the more traditional work that I do, it's a rare chance to do something a bit more creative. So I was having to sort of make up an arrangement of shells and seaweed and pearls and rocks going down this sort of sloping wall. And around the back, where there was two big rocks, I just carved a little crushed coke can in between the two
walls.
Nice. So even though it's from the 18th century, you know, I thought I'd leave my little record in there. And I didn't tell the owner of the house that I had done it. And I waited a couple of months to see if he would spot it. And he hadn't. And so then I fessed up and I said, you know, well, come around and have a look at this. And look, I've carved this. If you don't like it, I'll take it out, you know. And he basically just said, seeing as I didn't notice it, you got away with it, it's on me, and I like it. And now it's become a bit of a feature of it and a talking point. And it's, you know, it's not in your face. It's but the other thing that I did, which I haven't fessed up to yet, I'm still waiting to see if he notices, which he hasn't, but so around what the figures, they've got garlands, which is all like flowers and more shells and different things. So I had to do a whole one of the new figures. So her garland has got flowers and shells, and then within amongst that's a chip fork. Yeah, a little wooden chip fork.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that's,
yeah.
Even more, that's even harder to spot, but anyway, so that's there as well. So yeah.
But that's those beautiful things that can be a little secret that is owned just by the viewer, isn't it? That you come across, you discover something.
Exactly.
You're
yeah.
quite sure that no one else has discovered. Yeah, yeah, I love those yeah. sort of things anyway.
No, exactly. And it's also, you know, once someone knows about it, they'll actually, you know, that people have been taking people just to look at that, you know, it becomes, as well as the bridge and the carving that's there, it's like an extra thing, you know. It's the same as it can be done badly, this, but often on cathedrals. So I've worked on, you know, before I was, and I still do a bit of this, but I've worked on a few different cathedrals. I worked on St. Paul's in London and Wells, I was saying, about Somerset. But and often you see quirky little things that have been done by the stonemasons that you wouldn't be able to see unless you're up on the scaffolding.
Yeah.
But one of the things in that I saw in a cathedral in Spain that was a restoration was a devil with an ice cream cone, which from a 16th century church was obviously done much, much later on. But, you know, in amongst all the other detail, you can't really, you know, you don't really notice it unless you know and you have a look and you find it. You
well, the thing is, like you were saying about that bridge, Tom, in another 200 years, when people are talking about this 400-year-old bridge, they yeah. can say, well, this was restored in or around the start of the 21st century because the cheeky mason has, you know, sort of done this in there, you know.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah, love yeah. it. If there was you and five other artists, Tom, past and present, what would your ideal group show be?
Oh, it's a tough one, this, isn't it? So Richard Wilson, definitely, because of that Crude Oil piece that I saw and I love his work. And I met him and he's not really nice.
He's great, isn't he?
He's really great, yeah, yeah. And then Ron Muette, because I think his work is amazing. Who else? Jeremy Deller.
Nice.
Because that work, the sort of thing about art being an event and all, you know, that, you know, and also I sort of caught the end of the rave scene myself, so you know that whole that his work sort of really appeals to me. Who else? Well, Banksy, I reckon, because he's amazing, and then there's one more, isn't there? I suppose Gavin Turk as well. I mean, although my work could get a bit lost in amongst all that, I guess, wouldn't it? You know,
I mean, what a bunch of people. Yeah. I was thinking that as you was going through it, yeah. you know. How do you think, if you were able, you could collaborate with Banksy? Your eyes lit up when you mentioned him. That's what I asked.
I don't know. I mean, I was supposed to exhibit with someone called Dorcas Casey. She worked with Banksy on Dismal Land, and she did those horses on the Princess Carriage.
Yeah, yeah.
So she does a lot of animals out of fabric, and you know, it's amazing stuff, but I don't know really if you ever wanted anything carved in stone. maybe a stone version of the drinker.
The sculptors you mentioned, they've all got that same sort of humorous little twist to their work. They sort of come in on it from the similar sort of angle, don't they?
Exactly. And then I've heard you talk about this before, but then there's that fine line between humor in art and something just being a joke.
Yeah,
you know, and it's hard to know where that line is, isn't it? And
you don't tend to realize where it is until you've crossed it.
Exactly. And I guess maybe the thing is that the mixture of something serious and something funny, you know, that as long as it's balanced by something a bit more weighty behind it, I guess.
Yeah. If you wasn't an artist, Tom, what do you think you'd like to be?
Well, I can tell you what I probably would be, which is
unemployed.
Well, I'll probably still be doing just stonemasonry. I still do a lot of masonry, and so, like, for instance, at the moment I'm working at Royal Holloway College up in Egham in Surrey, and that is restoring a load of marble statues because there's this big statue of Thomas Holloway and these little figures all around it. Students climb up on it to get a traffic cone on the head.
Of course.
Because these figures have got all arms sticking out and stuff, they're knocking arms off and taking them away. Sure. So that I suppose is art. But if I wasn't doing my own work, I'd be doing that all the time, you know, the restoration side of it. But it's become more and more, you know, it started being about 50-50 of my own work and the restoration stuff. And now it's kind of probably more like 70, you know, 30, something like that. Yeah, so.
I presume what doing restorative work, would it keep you in touch with history still? Because your work is going very contemporary. Do you get the bit where you'll be working on someone else's work or looking at someone else's work and going, ah, that's how they've done that, yeah, as I see in a painting?
Yeah, no, exactly. No, I do, really. And also it all feeds in, I guess. So often artists will have to do something else to make money. You know, it's not all...
Teaching or what have you, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But so, and that feeds in as well, I guess. But, you know, it's good that I've got something that feeds in a practical sense. You know, my skills, you know, I'm always improving and I'm always thinking about, you know, it's always helped me think about what I'm going to do next and stuff. So yeah, no, it's I still really enjoy that side of it. Yeah.
Well, we done a little trip to Portland when I was at university, just for the weekend. Yeah, it's quite a mesmerizing thing to step back.
Yeah.
Time, as it were.
And did you see the Gormley sculpture there?
No, whether it was there, I mean, this is 2001.
It would have been there, but not many people know. So there's like a load of sculptors in that quarry have done carving straight into the rock face. So there's one by Peter Randall Page, and there's one by Anthony Gormley. There's a few, there's a lot, in, you know, but was it the old quarry that you were in, Tout Quarry then? Or was it the more?
We was in A Quarry.
Yeah, it probably was Tout. And then, so Gormley's got one, which is a man sort of falling down the cliff face. So.
I don't recall seeing any of those.
No, not in a different part. But it's a funny old place, Portland, isn't it?
Yeah. I know this sounds bad, but I wanted to go and see the prison.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's a prison that's pretty much carved into the stone anyway.
Yeah, no, that's name place. No, I've worked on the church. There's a church right in the middle of Portland. And I've worked, restored, like, years, this was years ago, putting back together gravestones that had been broken and fallen apart. So then I was staying on Portland, in a pub on Portland. Yeah, so I got to know it a bit, and it's a funny old place. And they're really superstitious about rabbits. Have you heard about that?
No.
So you can't say rabbit. You know, the old guys, they call them underground mutton, or they call them bunnies. You can say bunnies. Yeah. But it's because when there was a... landslide in the quarry, all the rabbits used to run out of the quarry. So the quarrymen thought that the rabbits were there, like digging away and undermining the tops.
Oh god, yeah.
But actually, I think the rabbits just feel the vibrations before people get out of there. But yeah, as a result, and there's rabbits all over the island, but they're really superstitious about rabbits. They just don't like them. You can't mention it. So.
Oh, they must have hated Chaz and Dave in the mid-80s, mustn't they?
Exactly, yeah. They'd be like, no, turn it off.
Got more underground mutton than Sainsbury's. Tom, have you got anything coming up?
The next thing, I'm working towards a show in Messon's, London, which is on Cork Street, and that's May next year. So I'm making all new work for that. So that's the next thing that I've got coming up. I'm busy sort of making work for that. There's, I think, 8 pieces in that, which would be a mixture of over life size. So I'm doing half the show as 5 times life-size pieces, and then the other half as life-size pieces, and they'll be sort of separate. So things like traffic cones made out of different coloured marbles. So it'll be a black marble at the bottom, red marble, white marble, so that's what I've got coming up. May next year, so it's a while off, really. But that's the thing about the type of work I make, is it takes a while. But that all came about because I was in a there's a Messons in Wiltshire, which is, they've got this big tithe barn, which is a huge space, and they had a show that was just in the summer about climate change. So my work kind of fits into that theme quite well, I think, especially the fossil pieces. So yeah. I was in that show, and from that they invited me to exhibit in their Mayfair gallery. So
nice.
So that's good. I have to send you an invite, Gary.
Oh, please do. Those fossil pieces, I know we're sort of backtracking a bit here, but that one that you mentioned where you've just got the plastic cup lid just appearing out of the top of a piece of stone. I love that sort of stuff.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, that's alabaster that I picked up when I went on a walk years ago, actually, with... you know, I took my family for a walk on the beach at Watchet. No, I took a big rucksack knowing there was loads of bits of alabaster lying around on the beach. And so, oh, look, what's that? You know, so that's actually a rock that's got a little white seam of alabaster within it that just fitted that coffee lid perfectly. And I keep needing to go and pick up more of that alabaster, which you can do it fairly guilt-free, because the thing about alabaster is once it's been in seawater, it just dissolves to nothing. So,
yeah.
So as soon as it comes out of the cliffs, you know, it hasn't got long on the beach before it just dissolves. So, yeah, it's not taking anything that's too precious. So
good. Tom, where can people see your work, be it website or social media?
The website is tomwarr.com, and my Instagram is tomwarrsculptor. So that's where you can see my stuff.
And war being W-A-U-G-H.
That's it. Yep. Yep.
Well, that's all my questions asked now, Tom.
Brilliant.
Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Gary. Thanks very much. I've enjoyed it. I'll let you know about this show in May next year.
Splendid. And I look forward to meeting you, mate.
Yeah. Cheers.
All the very best, Tom.
See you later, mate.
Ciao. Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. If you're unable to support us on Patreon, leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to this podcast really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast, or even giving us a positive shout out on your social media. Anything is appreciated, but either way, thanks for listening, and until next week, ta-da.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.